Spirit Blade Underground, episode 294. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for System 5. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 294.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and very unique community you're invited to check out at ChristianGeekCentral.com. Hi, I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources designed to equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you, like me, to live more and more for Christ. For more information and free goodies, check out spiritblade.net. On the show today, my quest for the ultimate dungeon crawl board game comes to an end, a pause, I'm not sure. We'll have to see. Plus, a look at the first of the five types of sacrifices common in the Old Testament and the relevance it has for our relationship with God and with each other today. All right, let's get to it.
You have fought well, human, but I am not defeated yet.
Blah, 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 whatever. You're going down, monkey boy. You're kidding me.
Critical failure. Sorry, Peter.
Yeah, I'll bet you are.
Don't forget to draw a card from the random disaster deck.
Yeah, I know. Shut up.
Spontaneous head implosion again.
Yes. Oh, crap. About a year and a half ago, I began what I call my quest for the ultimate dungeon crawl. As you might remember, if you listened to my HeroQuest review a few weeks ago, I'm a big fan of HeroQuest, or I was at the very least. I said a few weeks ago. Wasn't that just last week? I don't know. I'm like in a time warp. That's what this whole Christmas season does to me. It gets a little bit insane. I imagine if you guys are, whether you're plugged into your local church or not, you're probably feeling that extra bit of busyness. But especially if you're plugged in to things going on at your local church, there's a tendency for things to just kind of be happening and going on a lot. Good things, but busy things. Anyway, so whenever that HeroQuest review was, you probably picked up that I'm a big fan. But that's kind of in the past. See, I began playing HeroQuest in junior high, which would be 1990 to be specific, and I continued playing it throughout high school, throughout college, and beyond, adding numerous homebrewed rules to grant the game more complexity and challenge. Although I played HeroQuest happily for almost 15 years, sometime around 2004, the formula began to wear thin, and no amount of house ruling seemed enough to keep the magic alive. In 2005, I began playing Fantasy Flight Games' Descent Journeys in the Dark, which in many ways was structurally similar to HeroQuest, but with better components and more complex tactical rules. Descent was an amazing gaming experience that for years only became better as new expansions were added, including an epic campaign mode called the Road to Legend, which, like HeroQuest, now allowed hero characters to keep their equipment and continue advancing in their capabilities from one dungeon adventure to the next. But sometime around 2010, the rules of Descent began to feel cumbersome and the process of playing became a grind. I began to look for another way to scratch my strongly developed itch for dungeon crawling. For the last 3 years, then, I've played a number of games in an attempt to recapture the sense of excitement and wonder I experienced for so many years with HeroQuest. Today, I'm going to recall that journey and share with you which games came close, which games biffed it big time, and possibly which game rose above the rest to finally earn the title of Ultimate Dungeon Crawl. First, I should state the criteria I based this list on. The phrase dungeon crawl has not been definitively established in its meaning. What it may bring to mind or what elements may be considered vital to its essence will vary from player to player. For the purposes of my journey, the dungeon crawl had to have the following three elements. Number one, it must be fully cooperative or utilize a game master player. I loathe competition and so prefer to only play games where I am either working with all other players or helping provide a fun and challenging setting for them as the game master, but not really competing with them. Number two, it must have a D&D-ish fantasy theme. Doom the board game is in every other respect one of my favorite quote-unquote dungeon crawls, but I need to scratch that specific fantasy itch, and Doom wouldn't make the top spot in any case, though Doom and its expansion both hold a treasured place on my game shelf and continue to make for some great game nights. Number three, it must have character advancement. Must have character advancement. For me, no dungeon crawl is complete without the ability to upgrade the capabilities of your characters. At the very least, this should happen during gameplay, and preferably over the course of many games in a campaign style of play. For me, the essence of a dungeon crawl is that explore, fight, loot, upgrade, repeat. That is the dungeon crawl for me. Additional elements that were not required but that I found extremely beneficial to scratching my itch were, as I just said, a sense of exploration, a literal dungeon or underground environment somehow represented and obviously on the table in front of you, a party of adventurers working together, tactical combat with miniatures, and great-looking components. So all of those elements not required, but I found extremely beneficial to scratching my dungeon crawl itch. So the first game I'm going to talk about is HeroQuest. My evaluation of dungeon crawl board games can't even begin without first talking about Milton Bradley's HeroQuest. Since I just reviewed this game last week, I won't go into depth about it right now, but this is the game to which I compare all other tabletop dungeon crawls, and a game I returned to again as a part of my quest to find the ultimate dungeon crawl, to see if the magic could somehow be found again. HeroQuest was arguably the first of its breed, and few games in the same genre can match the staying power of this classic. I'd recommend checking out my review of HeroQuest, as an understanding of the basics of that game will serve as a primer for my exploration of the various dungeon crawl board games that followed it. So that's just last week's episode. I'd recommend, if you didn't listen to it, jump back there, listen to it, so you can kind of understand what the core experience of a board game dungeon crawl is, since pretty much every dungeon crawl board game owes its existence and a number of its rules and its general structure and feel to Milton Bradley's HeroQuest. So I'd recommend checking that out. I give an explanation of the rules, how turns work and stuff like that, and that serves as kind of a good primer for the other games I'm going to talk about. In many ways, HeroQuest powerfully distills the classic D&D experience into a much shorter, faster game that retains plenty of flavor, but it's more about tactics and strategy than actual role-playing. That said, the rules of HeroQuest are very simple. They're designed for players in their tween or early teen years. There was a time in my life when I couldn't imagine any way to improve upon HeroQuest, but eventually a number of games did. First of those in my mind is Descent. Descent First Edition from Fantasy Flight Games was released in 2005 and used a more polished, intuitive version of the rules created for Doom the board game, which had been released, I think, 2 or 3 years earlier. Instead of the static board and the changing door locations of HeroQuest, Descent used numerous dungeon tiles which fit together like puzzle pieces to form a nearly endless variety of dungeon layouts. Additionally, the Game Master player could spawn monsters on the board regularly and spring traps as he wished, instead of just adhering to some pre created map that he, you know, used to just put out monsters and traps on the board as the heroes came across them in their exploration. So the game master player, called the Overlord in this game, has a lot more choices, but he's limited by his available threat tokens, which is a sort of power currency that's gained and spent over the course of the game. Heroes had more tactical options as well. Instead of only 4 available hero options, Descent included 20 unique heroes to choose from, each with different stats and a unique special ability. Heroes could also gain new special abilities during play that created further variation. The base game alone had incredible replay value, but it lacked a proper campaign mode to allow for true character advancement. Even when this was corrected by an expansion years later, Descent still suffered from rules that were clunky and slow at times, introducing complexity that added thematic fun in the short term, but a bogged down play experience in the long term. As a part of my quest for the Ultimate Dungeon Crawl, I revisited Descent First Edition again with a group of players who had never played it before. They had a blast, while I continued to feel burned out on the game I once so passionately loved. I will always remember the superb production values and fantastic gaming sessions I had with Descent over the years, but the rules have long outworn their welcome at my table. Descent's second edition endeavored to clean up the rules and provide a game that took far less time to set up and play. This version of Descent was released just a couple of years ago. Fantasy Flight Games succeeded in creating rules that were familiar but incredibly streamlined, making play fast-paced and more consistently engaging for all those involved. But somewhere along the way, the ingredients of a true dungeon crawl, in my opinion, were left behind. The game board is set up in full at the start of the game. Every area of the board is fully revealed, eliminating any sense of exploration. Most of the loot to be found is either simple gold or one-use items like potions and stuff. The potential for discovered treasure to upgrade a hero character is virtually absent. Now, heroes may upgrade between play sessions with the gold and endgame bonuses acquired, but this feels less thematic and more like simply spending points. Finally, one of my biggest problems with the second edition is the new objectives given to the hero and game master players. Instead of the classic objective of, say, find the awesome relic and get out alive, or kill the big bad that lives in the dungeon, objectives for both sides of the conflict usually involve taking objects from one part of the board to another, or repeatedly passing some kind of non-combat check on a certain space on the board. Combat is still a big part of the game, but the only reason to engage in combat is to stop the opposing player, whether hero or bad guy, from getting in your way. Combat no longer feels like the meat of the game. And, you know, when I play this, I feel like, you know, I'm just kind of crossing paths with the heroes, because I always play the Overlord. And I feel like when they're kind of getting in my way, or they're doing something that's hindering my goal, then I'll engage in combat to get them out of my way. But it's not like this epic struggle, like, I am evil and I will destroy you. And it's, you know, and he's never, I didn't find a single quest in the quest book for the base set of the game that was telling the heroes, your goal is to go and kill dude. It was kill dude before he does this or whatever, but I mean, it just doesn't feel the same to me. It doesn't feel like the meat of the game. It's just a necessary evil that must be dealt with in order to advance your agenda in the game. In short, although Descent 2.0 technically meets my criteria for being called a dungeon crawl, it just doesn't feel like one to me in many respects. So moving on, Thunderstone. Thunderstone is in many ways a departure from what I normally think of as a dungeon crawl. It does not utilize a game master, and its default mode of play is competitive, not cooperative. It also doesn't utilize miniatures or have a board representing the corridors and rooms of a dungeon. Instead, Thunderstone is one of the first examples of a deck-building game, in which players all begin with the same set of cards in a small deck and add new cards to them this set as the game progresses, cycling through their deck numerous times before the game is finished. But despite these unorthodox elements, the dungeon crawl theme is strongly present in the gameplay. As you defeat monsters, you earn experience and often gain more gold to spend in town, upgrading your capabilities, hiring heroes, or training them to be more effective. You're doing all kinds of cool customization to your deck. The deeper you delve into the dark reaches of the dungeon, the more light sources you'll need to remain effective there. And a co-op variant included in the game allows for an intense adventure with friends. The game involves a great deal of enjoyable puzzle solving and tactical thinking. There are no dice in the game and almost no luck involved in combat. This creates a sense of accomplishment when you figure out how to use the resources in your hand to get the job done. Mechanically speaking, the game's very satisfying. The rules are easy to understand and the game moves at a nice pace even as more players are added. Having given it so much praise, however, Thunderstone is not the ultimate dungeon crawl for me. It lacks the potential for long-term advancement. In each game, you start from scratch, carrying over no spoils or upgrades from previous game sessions. There are also times when the puzzle-solving nature overrides the theme, resulting in a momentarily abstracted experience. If the publishers of Thunderstone, AEG, ever create a solid rule set for campaign play, it will probably be a must-buy expansion for me. Thunderstone is enjoyable, but doesn't quite scratch the dungeon crawl itch for me. So for now, it's a game I'll keep in my collection, but primarily for the nights my gaming group wants to play it. For a more detailed description of gameplay, you can listen to my full review of Thunderstone in episode 218 of the Spirit-Laid Underground podcast. Moving on, Mage Knight. Mage Knight, the board game, is a unique game in my collection. It's complex and strategic with very little luck and a great degree of concentration required. Yet because of fantastic player aids, there are not a large number of rules you need to memorize. Like Thunderstone, players customize a deck over the course of the game and use their cards to win in combat or achieve other feats required for victory. The puzzle-solving aspect is much like that in Thunderstone, but with many more variables and possibilities to consider. And also, unlike Thunderstone, there's not near as much customizing of your deck over the course of the game. In addition to these zoomed-in encounters played out using the cards in your hand and other abilities at your disposal, there's a larger epic game in which your character is exploring an overworld map, attempting to conquer a new land or otherwise use it for your own purposes. In Mage Knight, you can play the hero or the villain. You can influence or threaten people to serve under you. You can learn secret skills at monasteries or burn them to the ground to steal precious artifacts. You can lay siege to fortresses and mage towers or seek out treasures in deep dungeons. Mage Knight lets you create a story of epic conquest, but also includes zoomed-in combat encounters. The game plays best co-op or solo. I mean, one to two players, I think, is honestly the sweet spot. And solo, I gotta say, is the way I most often find myself playing it. Even many seasoned board gamers aren't interested in devoting the amount of time and focus required to play a complete game of Mage Knight, which runs at least 2 hours in the shorter scenarios, and that's after setup, and more often lasts 3 to 4 hours of focused gaming. So those who enjoy casual rabbit trail conversations over the game table should steer clear of this one, unless you want to be at that table forever. Mage Knight is an incredible board game experience. It's possibly the most skillfully designed game I've ever played. If I've got the time, have had enough sleep, and don't feel especially in need of conversation, I will probably never turn down the opportunity to play this awesome game. But it's not the ultimate dungeon crawl for me. First and most obviously, it's not truly about crawling through dungeons. It fits much better into the category of adventure game. Yet it contains all three of my required elements for a dungeon crawl, and so I felt it was at least worth consideration. Secondly, like Thunderstone, there is no option for campaign play. Each new game is like hitting the reset button with no spoils or skills carried over from previous games. A little bit of a bummer. If somehow campaign play could be introduced, and if somehow the dungeon exploration could include the tactical movement of miniatures through a dungeon board, the game would be beyond amazing. but it would also be impossible to play with any regularity due to the increased complexity these changes would just have to bring. Mage Knight may be the most impressive game I own, but it falls short when I need a true dungeon crawl experience. For my complete review of Mage Knight the board game, check out episode 257 of this podcast. Next up, Pathfinder. I had nearly given up in my quest for the ultimate dungeon crawl when I heard about Paizo Publishing's attempt to reduce the Pathfinder paper and pencil RPG experience to a streamlined card game experience. More than any game I have played since Descent First Edition, Pathfinder the Adventure Card Game evokes the classic feel of the D&D dungeon crawl. Despite the fact that many encounters do not take place in dungeons, the sense of exploration is present in every turn, and the theme is surprisingly strong given that there are no miniatures used in the game and locations are represented by decks of cards. In this fully cooperative experience, you can fall prey to the temptations of the sultry shopkeeper's daughter, become trapped in a collapsing dungeon, recruit allies to join you by persuading them charismatically or impressing them with your skills, and enter epic combat with dragons and the undead. You can learn skills as you explore or acquire new equipment that you may immediately put to use. You can also keep the best of what you learn or find for the next game, slowly advancing your chosen character, sculpting them into your ultimate vision of what they could be. Character stats make each hero unique in both how they play and how they thematically feel. Like Thunderstone and Mage Knight, you put the cards in your hand to the best possible use in order to come out on top, but the luck element introduced by dice keeps any decision from being stuck in analysis paralysis. Rich in theme but easy to learn and play, Pathfinder the Adventure Card Game just may turn out to be the ultimate dungeon crawl for me. But it's too early to say. However, with regular expansions published every 2 months that continue one massive campaign story, I don't think it's going to be long before I have my answer here. Even so, there may be one more contender for the title. Now, I already mentioned HeroQuest at the start of this exploration of game titles, but I didn't go into the potential the game has, which I talk about more in my review. The potential for HeroQuest is found in the numerous variant rules and expansions for the game created by devoted fans who have kept the game alive without fail for the last 25 years. In fact, as I mentioned last week, there's a 25th anniversary edition of the game in the works by a company in Spain, which when it's finished, you'll be able to order it from Spain storefronts and then they'll ship it over to the US. But there are currently some changes going on in the development that may allow it to be sold directly through US retailers after all. So that's going to be a very interesting thing for me to kind of follow and keep track of. And those could be available as early as December 2014 from US retailers. I mean, we'll see how the whole thing shakes out. But even if this new edition of the game falls apart, it's clear from its very existence in the developmental stage that there is a strong audience for HeroQuest. As I mentioned, I've recently returned to the game, but I've, in addition to trying out the basic rules again, I've also used some variants of my own mixed with some variants previously established by others. In its current state, at my gaming table, with my variants and a few other variants added in, HeroQuest is faster and more streamlined than Descent First Edition, but still has all the tactical fun and rich thematic gameplay of that game. It has such enormous and seemingly endless potential. I've played this new variant of the game a number of times now with different groups, and it so far has great appeal to both HeroQuest newcomers and at least one grizzled HeroQuest veteran aside from myself. So the next year will be very interesting as I continue my quest. Pathfinder may prove to take the crown through continued innovation and an increase in the already active development of fan-made characters and adventures you can find at BoardGameGeek.com. A year from now, we'll also likely have an entirely new version of HeroQuest with updated rules and improved components that will be worthy of strong consideration. But for now, I think I have to bring my gaming life full circle and award the title of Ultimate Dungeon Crawl to what is for me the game of all games, the Peter Franson edition of HeroQuest. Well, I want to remind you guys to check out the other podcasts in the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, and the Untold podcast. This month on the Untold podcast, Lizzie sees time differently, but how does she use this ability in this strange tale by Critical Press Media's own Winston Crutchfield? For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
In this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the churchy language we take for granted, using a little cultural history and linguistics now and then to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and apply some of what God has for us in these words today. This time, we're looking at Leviticus chapter 1, verses 1 through 17. And I'll actually get back on track with reading them. This isn't, you know, terrible in terms of like being boring and like reading the phone book like some of the previous stuff that that we've kind of been looking at. So I'll go ahead and give this a shot. Again, Leviticus 1, 1 through 17 in the ESV reads, Yahweh called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, When any one of you brings an offering to Yahweh, you shall bring your offering of livestock from the herd or from the flock. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting that he may be accepted before Yahweh. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. Then he shall kill the bull before Yahweh, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall bring the blood and throw the blood against the sides of the altar that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Then he shall flay the burnt offering and cut it into pieces, and the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall put the sons of Aaron the priest shall put the fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall arrange the pieces, the head, and the fat on the wood that is on the fire on the altar. But its entrails and its legs he shall wash with water. And the priest shall burn all of it on the altar as a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to Yahweh. If his gift for a burnt offering is from the flock, from the sheep or goats, he shall bring a male without blemish, and he shall kill it on the north side of the altar before the Lord. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall throw its blood against the sides of the altar, and he shall cut it into pieces with its head and its fat, and the priest shall arrange them on the wood that is on the fire on the altar, but the entrails and the legs he shall wash with water. And the priest shall offer all of it and burn it on the altar. It is a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to Yahweh. If his offering to Yahweh is a burnt offering of birds, then he shall bring his offering of turtle doves or pigeons, and the priest shall bring it to the altar and wring off its head and burn it on the altar. Its blood shall be drained out on the sides of the altar. He shall remove its crop with its contents and cast it beside the altar on the east side in the place for ashes. He shall tear it open by its wings, but shall not sever it completely, and the priest shall burn it on the altar on the wood that is on the fire. It is a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to Yahweh. So in my reading, I tried to kind of emphasize a few of the points that we're going to be zooming in on as we look at these verses a little bit more closely. First off, looking at verse 3, the animal offered was to be a male without blemish. Males were somewhat expendable, since only a few would be required to produce many offspring in the herd or the flock, but they were also the most valuable, the most productive, and the most strong. So giving one up for sacrifice was just what the word implies, a sacrifice. But as King David later observed, there's something wrong with the idea of giving God something that doesn't inconvenience us in any way. Check out 2 Samuel 24:24. When I served as the worship pastor of our church a number of years ago, before launching Spirit-Led Productions, we were going through a time of great change in that ministry that was difficult for everyone. God was calling us to something higher and better in our approach to worshiping Him corporately. But pursuing that course meant a lot of change, which came with some painful stretching and growth for the volunteers, for myself, for everybody. During this time, the sacrificial system of the Old Testament and the life of King David served as somewhat of a source of inspiration to me. Above the door to our music rehearsal room, I posted a paraphrase of David's words from 2 Samuel 24:24, which read, "I will not offer to God that which costs me nothing." All right, looking at verse 4. Here we have a strange procedure described that is found in a number of Old Testament rituals. There is some disagreement about what exactly is meant by the action of the offerer laying their hands on the offering before it's consumed. For quite a while, it's been concluded that this action represents some form of substitution, as the object of sacrifice becomes the representative of the offerer. It's not that sin is transferred to the object of sacrifice, but rather that the object stands in place of the offerer in some way. Now, there does seem to be some kind of at least symbolic transfer of sin happening in the way this action is described in Leviticus 16, 21 and 22, and I'll let you guys check that out on your own, but this symbolic action is not always done, this, you know, laying on the hands of the object of sacrifice or offering. It's not always done in the context of dealing with sin, and so it can't be assumed to always have this meaning. So for this reason, I've concluded that substitution seems to be the common link between all uses of this action in sacrificial rituals. It's also consistent with the work of Jesus, who became the ultimate object of sacrifice, standing in our place when the time for justice and punishment came. The Hebrew word for atonement here, it's used about 150 times in the Old Testament. It's a key word worth looking at, trying to understand. In its root form, it conveys the idea of covering or hiding, but later came to mean pacify, cleanse, forgive, or make reconciliation. In whatever sense these ancient sacrifices and offerings atoned for sin, you know, maybe forgave or made reconciliation for sin, we know that their effectiveness was temporary at best. And we see that in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 1 and 2 in the ESV, really presents the reasoning very well. The author there says, "For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have any consciousness of sins?" All right, moving on to verse 5 now. The symbolic implication of sacrificial blood sprinkled on the sides of the altar is that in order to meet with Yahweh, sacrifice is required. That altar was right outside the place where the high priest would meet with Yahweh. And so the implication there seems to be that sacrifice is required in order to have that connection, that meeting with Yahweh. And again, this is, I think, consistently it's pairing the ideas of God's desire for relationship with the need for His separation from us, from humanity, until sin is dealt with. Now verses 6 through 13, the entrails and legs were specifically washed so that there would be no animal dung on the altar. So we're offering this sacrifice, but we want to remove any imperfections, any impurities. I mean, that's, you see that, you know, it starts with the male, the valued member of the flock, and that doesn't have any blemish, doesn't have any imperfections, and then also this kind of last step of removing anything that could be seen as kind of like imperfect or, you know, dirty or whatever. They wash the feces off of and out of the intestines and the legs. The offering is described as a food offering with a, quote, pleasing aroma. The food sacrifice was pleasing to Yahweh, but He did not require it or actually eat it as a meal, unlike, say, the gods of religions in the surrounding areas during this time, who did require, many of them, food sacrifices to subsist and they needed to eat or whatever. So there's something different going on here. The aroma is pleasing, but he's not actually, it's never saying here that he's eating it or that he needs to eat it or anything like that. Okay, verses 14 through 17, the various animals mentioned here are included as options dependent on the desire and wealth available to the offerer. So someone that had extra money and wanted to maybe, under special circumstances, just devote more, stretch their finances a little bit thinner to offer a more expensive, valuable sacrifice, you know, they could do that. Or those who were not as well off, who even struggling couldn't do that, they would have the birds as an option, for folks with a really low income. So just in summary, regarding the burnt offering, despite it being described first, it wasn't the most common sacrifice offered, nor was it mandatory, which will become more obvious as we notice the change in wording when mandatory sacrifices are described later on. I think it's hard to overstate the massive change in status quo that Jesus brought. His sacrifice meant, among many other things, doing away with this entire way of approaching God with our concerns. I mean, compare this entire chapter, including its detailed instructions and the groundwork laid for this ritual and the construction of the tabernacle, which we've spent weeks looking at. Compare all of that with the simple, concise words of the Apostle Paul. Philippians 4, verse 6 in the ESV says, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God." As a geek, I often feel like something of an outsider, whether real or only perceived. And I think, if I'm honest with myself, a lot of it is just kind of perception I put on there, just my insecurities. And it's not actually anybody that's doing anything to make me an outsider. I kind of make myself an outsider. But anyway, whether real or only perceived, I feel as though in order to fit in with some groups, I have to be more physically attractive or more stylish or more charismatic or conversant in the memes of the day. Is that how you pronounce that word, by the way? Memes? I sure hope it is. But anyway, I kind of feel like I have to kind of be in the know with certain things or, you know, just fit into a certain mold. I feel a number of little hoops I need to jump through in order to develop friendships with some people. Not many people in my case, you know, but every now and then I get that feeling. Unlike the dysfunctional people that we all are, God has every reason to expect some hoop jumping from those that want to have a relationship with him. It was right for him to expect what he did from even those who came to him voluntarily. But now God has made it possible for us to come to him at any given moment, under any circumstances, without deep meditation or a lengthy preparation in advance. I remember years ago, and I won't mention the specific faith, but there was some friends that were from another faith that has a lot of legalistic tendencies in it, a lot of them. And they came and visited the church, and they just kind of, you know, were taken aback a little bit at how, you know, our pastor, you know, when he was ending his sermon, he would just suddenly at the end of his sermon just kind of close his eyes and immediately launch into prayer. There wasn't like this pause for quiet. There wasn't like this, you know, physical change, folding of arms or hands, or this kind of centering of self. It was just like, you know, he finished the sermon and, like, without even taking a breath, closed his eyes and immediately started interacting with Yahweh and leading the congregation in that. And that was foreign to them. They were, I think, used to this more kind of like, okay, you know, we got to get in a certain mode before we start conversing with the God of the universe. And, you know, when you're in a legalistic, a works-based system like this particular faith, and like what Israel was under in many respects in the Old Testament time, well, that makes sense. But because of what Jesus has done, none of that stuff applies. And it wasn't working for anybody, wasn't working in the past, doesn't work now anyway, you know? So Jesus places his perfect record in place of our own. So approaching God with our concerns, be they big or small, be they like, how am I going to, you know, pay for rent, or man, where are my keys? God, could you help me find my car keys? I'm in a little bit of a rush, you know, or all the little, the small big things, you know, whatever. It's no more presumptuous for us to approach Jesus, to approach the Father with that, than it is for Jesus to approach God the Father. When we may feel like a fifth wheel or an oddball in other groups as geeks, we can rest in knowing that, you know, God wants to hear our thoughts. He wants to hear our dreams, our fears. He knows all that. But I mean, look at your Psalms. There's still obviously some value. There's some interest on his part in just hearing people talk about their situations, even though he knows their whole situations. There's something God honoring, something good, something he wants in that kind of like, oh, God, here's where I'm at today. You know, this is what I'm feeling right now. And maybe I'm in the wrong, maybe I'm in the right, I don't know. I'm just a whole mess of emotions and stuff right now, and I'm just going to dump it all on the table, and other people would find this conversation really awkward, and, you know, but I'm just going to talk out loud in a room with no people. I'm going to talk to Yahweh. I'm just going to go into it, you know, and he wants that, and he's invited us into that, and that's possible because of what Jesus has done for us. He's interested in sharing all of that day-to-day stuff at any given moment, at every given moment with us. And I think this can, again, serve as a model for how we should aim to openly allow others access to friendship with us.
Incoming transmission.
Well, I got an email this week from someone, and I'm going to just leave their name out of the equation, who was just feeling discouraged, feeling a little bit, you know, I think unsuccessful, and you know, just like not meeting the standards of expectations of others around them. And just not meeting the standards of what they viewed as being successful in life. And it just really resonated with me. And so I just want to share with you my response to that person. So hopefully if you're kind of in a similar kind of situation, you're feeling some of those same feelings of discouragement, just kind of feeling down on yourself about how you look or what you're doing with your life or not doing with your life or whatever, I hope in this response that I sent to this person that you'll feel some encouragement too. I wrote, I felt for you and the discouragement you're feeling about yourself. I think I felt it in part because I can relate to it so well. In so many ways, I feel like a failure. I'm failing in my marketing efforts, failing as a businessman, failing to financially provide for my family, failing to reach the number of people I want to reach through my audio dramas, failing to reach the number of people I want to reach with my podcast, failing. I wonder how many people in my life think I'm just pissing my day away and letting Holly, my wife, do all the work while I dink around in fantasy land. It's a feeling I'm battling all the time, an almost constant feeling of discontent with the amount of success I've had in my life. A few months ago, I was pretty mired in this kind of sludgy thinking. I don't know if sludgy is a word, but it is now. And in the natural progression of my reading through the book of Matthew, I came across this moment where Jesus, and I'll just read it from Matthew 16, 21 through 23, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." Now, Peter and many Jews at this time were anticipating the Messiah to be a political leader who would take the world by force and unstoppably set up his kingdom despite any opposition. So to Peter, all this talk about Jesus being condemned by the most important and influential spiritual leaders of the day, humiliated and then killed, all that sounded like an absolute catastrophe. He saw the worst kind of failure imaginable in this scenario. And I mean, I can't blame him, can you? But Jesus didn't hesitate to come down hard on that kind of thinking. Peter's ideas of success and failure were the kind of mentality that Satan stimulates and spreads. Concepts of success and failure based on the human thinking of the day. So my quest is to rewire my shorted out brain and remind myself that my ideas of success have nothing to do with God's ideas of success, which are the true definition of success. And in the blink of an eye, this life is going to be over, and the things that last in eternity won't be the amount in our bank accounts or the size of our waistlines. I hope something in all of that is encouraging to you. I don't pretend to have this one beat yet. As I said, I'm plagued by bad definitions of success continually, but I hope you'll take some encouragement from the truth of what success really is and is not, and stand back to back with me in the trenches as we both fight off these nasty mentalities that Satan hopes will cripple our effectiveness in the things that really matter. Well, guys, on that note, feedback, input, I want to hear from you. You can request a review, give me your thoughts, questions, whatever. It all helps me make this show better. Go to spiritblade.net/underground to record a message with your computer, or send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net. All right, just another reminder that you can now get both the Spirit Blade Underground podcast and the Untold podcast in a single feed, along with all the written reviews and content published at Christian Geek Central. You can find this magical feed at, you guessed it, ChristianGeekCentral.com. Also, this month and this month only, it's something I do once a year, so a lot of you guys have probably heard this and you're like sick of hearing it now, but I put together a kind of a dark electronic version of this, of the Christmas carol O Come O Come Emmanuel, that you can download for free at spiritblade.net/freestuff. I put it up every year throughout the month of December, so it's up there now, so if you haven't heard it yet, or if you have but you're not sick of it yet, you can go download it anytime this month at spiritblade.net/freestuff. All right, well, next week, if God wants it to happen, I'm going to have a review of The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, and I'll also share a retro review of the movie Aeon Flux. Till then, thanks so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Friends and with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.net. Thank you for listening.